Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
Okay, from Live Science. Orcas have been filmed for the first time in the wild making out.
Oh, so we're peeping Toms now, is what we're...
Yeah, effectively, science is voyeurism. Let's get into it. Because effectively, that is a lot of the scientific process, mm-hmm. right? You have to like to watch. So if that describes you, well, we have footage now that captures a pair of orcas, specifically French kissing, i.e. nibbling each other's tongues. So to be clear, this is for the first time ever we have spotted them making out in the wild.
But not the first time they've spotted us making out in the
right?
wild.
Yeah, I feel like they've been watching us for a long time.
Right, like we may have just found the exhibitionist orcas, right? But this particular pair was observed during a snorkeling exhibition in the fjords of northern Norway. Now, the interaction lasted just under 2 minutes. It involved three bouts of gentle mouth-to-mouth contact. Afterward, the pair swam their separate ways.
Not even going to cuddle afterwards? It's so selfish.
Like, you know, it just may not have been the right fit, right? Like, you ever make out with someone, you're like, oh, this is incorrect,
never mind.
Right?
You've got coffee breath. I can't.
Exactly. Now, we did first see this behavior in captive orcas. So the orca caretakers at several facilities are aware of the behavior, but the prevalence is low. So many social animals use mouth contact to reinforce bonds, like primates who engage in kissing or lip touching as a sign of trust. With dogs or wolves, they do a form of mouth licking, especially from younger or subordinate individuals, to represent respect or submission to a higher ranking individual in the pack. As for our orca whales, the researchers suggest that this might be a form of social bonding, kind of like how we see in belugas. The tongue nibbling itself has not been recorded in other species, but it's comparable to mouth-related social interactions. So given the cetacean anatomy, according to the scientists, oral contact may serve as a more versatile means of social communication than in terrestrial animals.
Right. It's hard to hug underwater.
It is. We, of course, are not totally certain as to what this is actually about. This is all speculation. In captivity, the social structure is completely artificial and therefore largely irrelevant for understanding social function in evolutionary terms, which was a parenthetical part of the quote, but whew, it's doing a lot of heavy lifting, not just in the orca world, but everywhere else, right? Mm. It may be affiliative. It might be a form of begging, like maybe trying to stimulate food transfers. But observing the same behavior in wild orcas confirms this is a natural behavior retained in orcas under human care. So very different environments, it's still a connection.
Yeah, I mean, they still did it in front of people. So, right. like, it could just be that they're like, oh, this is the thing we do to freak the people out.
Yeah, they don't mention the sex of the animals either.
That's true.
They didn't.
Maybe they couldn't tell from a distance.
Right. So, if you are snorkeling in the northern fjords, or if you happen to be around some orcas, just keep your eyes peeled, right?
Yeah. Or try French kissing underwater, because it might be awesome.
With another human, right?
We're just going to stay in that way. Yes, no, the orca's going to kill you if you try.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from BBC.com. It's titled, Japan Islanders Sleepless After 900 Earthquakes in 2 Weeks.
Wow. Okay, I would be actually leaving the area if that were the case.
Yeah, so more than 900 earthquakes have shaken in the seas around the Tokara Islands since 21st of June, authorities said, after a magnitude 5.5 earthquake struck on Wednesday. One resident told the regional broadcaster NBC, it's very scary to even fall asleep. It feels like it's always shaking.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's pretty much just one earthquake.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a constant.
Yeah, you're living on a boat, except you're actually terrestrial.
Yeah. So the Tokara area has experienced clusters of earthquakes in the past, but the frequency of the most recent tremors has been unusual, according to local media. Japan is one of the most seismically active nations on Earth, owing to its location on the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire, where many tectonic plates meet. It experiences about 1,500 earthquakes each year. About 700 people live on 7 of the 12 Tokara Islands. There are no hospitals on some of these far-flung islands. The nearest is at least 6 hours by ferry to the prefectural capital, Kagoshima. In Toshima Village, some residents have been sleep-deprived and tired, authorities said, as they urge the media to stop inundating locals with queries. A notice on the village website says, "We ask that you be considerate and not make excessive inquiries or interviews."
That's funny. They're like, the earthquakes are annoying, but the reporters are worse. Like, just stop.
It's basically describing a state of chronic PTSD, and they're like, please don't add to it. Please.
Right. Yeah.
This series of tremors come as the country as a whole has been kept on edge by rumors that a massive, deadly quake could soon hit. A 1999 comic book by manga artist Ryo Tatsuki has been fueling these rumors.
What?
So in a new edition released in 2021, she claimed that the next big earthquake, and I looked this up, I think she had a dream about it, that there would be a magnitude 8 earthquake, and that would strike on July 5th this year. As of this recording, it did not occur.
It did not.
I think we would have heard about that by
but
now.
But mathematically, those 900 broken up over a period of time.
Yeah, it's pretty on point, right? I was like, regardless, like, that's a pretty wild earthquake incident.
Right.
However, authorities have for decades feared the big one, a once-in-a-century megaquake that many had grown up being warned about. Worst-case scenarios predict it could leave more than 300,000 dead. Earlier this week, the government called for new measures, such as constructing embankments and evacuation buildings to strengthen public readiness in case of such a disaster, but it warned that much more needs to be done.
Yeah, I really want to make a Godzilla joke, but it doesn't seem appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, there is an element of, like you said, it's like getting your sea legs, where at some point, if the vibration is constant, you kind of get used to it, and then if you try to travel somewhere where it doesn't shake, you can't walk straight anymore.
But you expect that. That's why we call it sea legs. We don't call them quake legs, because it's not a phenomenon that's supposed to occur, right?
I'm saying it could be. They talk about the big one hitting California as well, and a ton of tiny earthquakes is better. That's ideally how you want it to go. There's less destruction. So maybe this is like prep work. When it starts happening over here, we'll be like, oh, let's go talk to the quake leg people and see what they can offer us.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, in a strange way, this kind of relates. This is from Discover. Could your nightmares come from cheese? Maybe if you're lactose intolerant. So maybe she just ate a bunch of cheese before her prediction.
Right.
So a slice of cheddar or brie or sprinkled parmesan, they might be the dream of cheese lovers, but for people with lactose intolerance, they are literally the stuff of nightmares. According to a new study, it's possible that the consumption of cheese and other dairy products can contribute to poor sleep and nightmares among lactose intolerant individuals. The study involved over 1,000 participants who were asked about their diets, sleep patterns, and perceptions of the relationships between the two. The results revealed that lactose intolerance, poor sleep, and nightmares are all closely connected, possibly thanks to the gastrointestinal distress that's caused by dairy, which could interfere with sleep and dreams of those who consume it. So even though I'm not lactose intolerant or intolerant-ish, definitely when I would eat ice cream before going to bed, bad things would happen.
Yeah, I mean, I take a little issue with the opening line of it because there actually is very little lactose in aged cheeses. So like cheddar and parmesan, really very little lactose. Brie has it, and ice cream definitely would have it. I'm just saying, like, the guy who wrote the opening sentence doesn't know where lactose is. That's all.
I didn't either. I assumed it was...
You want your soft, milky milks? That's going to mess you up. If you get your sharp and hard, you're going to maybe have some, I don't know, spirit engagement while you sleep.
Well, like, the aging process consumes the lactose. So the older the cheese is, the less lactose it's going to have in it. Can you tell I have some lactose intolerance in my family?
That's super handy to know. I mean, as far as like how to choose the right cheese before bed.
Yeah. Well, and it may literally be that it's not the lactose necessarily, that like you could have other problems with cheese that will also give you nightmares. It doesn't sound like they necessarily separated what kind of cheese these people were eating before bed.
No, and there's still a lot of, we'll get to it, there's still a lot of studies to be done. Mm-hmm. But they have noticed that nightmare severity is, according to Tor Nielsen, the study's author, it is robustly associated with lactose intolerance and other food allergies. These new findings imply that changes in eating habits for people with some food sensitivities could alleviate nightmares. That's also, I don't know, about alleviate nightmares. They could also explain why people so often blame dairy for bad dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Though we all eat and sleep, there has been a lack of research in the potential between the relationship between the two.
That feels like an oversight.
But here's the thing. You're not getting a drug to fix that. You're getting don't eat that before bed. And people aren't going to do that. So,
yeah, because this was also, to your all's point, this research is being done in the University of Montreal, University of British Columbia, and McEwen University, which I assume is also in Canada. So that's where the studies were done. So yeah, to your point, a little less capitalism involved there in Canada.
Yeah, well, and just American stubbornness. Like, Canadians, if you say like, hey, would you like to live longer and not have nightmares? They're like, well, okay, I'll consider that. Americans are like, no, I want to die sooner and have more nightmares just because you told me not to.
So after reviewing the responses, the team found that female respondents reported food intolerances more frequently than male ones. And they also reported poor sleep and nightmares more frequently as well. Still, around a third of participants, male and female, reported nightmares overall. Moreover, specific foods were reported to affect sleep by approximately 40% of the students and to have a negative impact on sleep by around 25%. Even smaller, around 5.5% of the participants reported that specific foods altered their dreams, with sweet foods, spicy foods, and of course, dairy products being blamed most often for the dream alterations. So we're routinely asking whether food affects dreaming, and it seems that we have some answers now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I know for a fact I get a lot of nightmares even when I haven't had any dairy. So
right. My teeth falling out nightmares, I don't think are caused by the food.
Well, yeah, because dairy strengthens your teeth. It can't be that.
But if you're eating sugar before bed, maybe there's some symbolism there, right?
And, you know, that's the thing they hit at the end of this article. We need a lot more research, and we need to study people of different ages, because this was all just college students.
Mm-hmm.
Also, experimental studies need to determine if people can truly detect the effects, because these were just surveys.
Right. Self-reported intolerances, which...
And we know college students have such good self-awareness.
Right. This also tracks to back why more females responded than the males did.
I was like, there's nothing wrong with me. Lactose intolerance is weak.
I eat this all night. It's totally
Do you
fine.
Even lift, bro?
Wheels of cheese.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got a fascinating article from Wired about how memories are even possible. Because, you know, fully aside from how connections are made between our synapses in the first place, there's the question of how they could persist. Because our brains are made up of organic material, which rather famously degrades and is replaced every few months, weeks, or sometimes even days. So if a memory is encoded and then a molecule involved in that connection breaks down, how does a new molecule know to take its place? And how can it even be the same memory once the connection has been broken? So the main researcher we're following here is a guy named Todd Sachter, who got into neuroscience for a pretty traumatic reason. When he was just under 3 years old, his sister died from leukemia, and he basically doesn't remember her except for one specific thing. He remembers asking her to read him a book, and she brushed him off and said, "Go ask your mother." So, yeah, obviously it's not a happy memory, and he became kind of obsessed as he got older with the idea that he wanted to remember happy things about her, like his grieving parents clearly did, but also how it was kind of insane for him to have any memories from so young an age. So, Sachter became a neuroscientist, and his first major breakthrough came in the early 90s when he was studying the hippocampus of rats and discovered that when he stimulated them in a way that mimicked memory encoding, which they don't explain at all, but apparently was a thing we could do. When he did this, he noticed that there was always an increase in the presence of a particular substance called protein kinase M zeta, or PKM zeta, and he became convinced that this molecule was crucial for the formation of memories. So he spent the next decade refining his theory and doing more studies, proving that he could not only prevent the formation of new memories in a rat by blocking PKM zeta, but that he could also erase old memories.
Ooh.
And this was, by the way, pretty clearly the inspiration for the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which came out just 2 years after Sachter's groundbreaking announcement that he could erase specific memories in a living rat without wiping everything. But then they hit a roadblock, because what Sachter had been doing was blocking PKM zeta in existing rats. But in 2013, two other research labs genetically engineered some rats to be lacking PKM zeta from the start. And these rats were still able to form and maintain memories. So Sachter fired back, publishing a paper in 2016 that showed, yes, the rats' brains could recruit a compensatory protein to do the job of PKM zeta if it was missing, but that this compensatory protein was basically a very, very similar molecule to PKM zeta, and that blocking this lesser molecule in normal mice didn't affect their memories at all. So it was clearly only a backup and not as important as the real thing. But it did raise an important question, which was, how did the backup molecule know where to go if the structure that it was fitting into wasn't even meant for it in the first place? And how, for that matter, did any PKM zeta molecule know where to go to maintain a long-term memory when they were constantly degrading and being replaced in the brain? And that's the big breakthrough that they have just now solved. Because in 2020, during a paper presentation from a rival research team at McGill University, a graduate student named Matteo Bernabò was discussing a new PKM zeta inhibitor that they had just discovered but still didn't know how it worked. And a member of the audience named Wayne Sossen suggested that maybe it was disrupting the connection between PKM zeta and a scaffolding protein called Kibra. Now, Kibra was, as far as we knew, a very boring protein. It didn't seem to do anything except provide a structure for more important proteins to build on. According to Sossen, quote, "There's only three or four of us studying it in the whole world." But Sachter was interested in anything related to his own pet protein, however insignificant it might seem, so he joined forces with the team from McGill to investigate the potential connection between Kibra and PKM zeta. And what they found was everything. Because, for one thing, disrupting the bond between Kibra and PKM zeta erased old memories just as effectively as blocking the presence of PKM zeta in the first place. But more importantly, when they disrupted just the PKM zeta or the Kibra molecule, but left the bonding structure in place on whichever one remained, a new molecule was able to float on over and reattach to the existing bond. And that, they realized, is how a memory can persist when our bodies are constantly being replaced, because the PKM zeta and the Kibra actually operate in pairs. So either half is able to maintain the structure long enough to get a new partner if they lose theirs. And then once you add a new molecule, the older one can now safely die and be replaced. And you end up with this ongoing ship of Theseus effect, where the structure is always maintained even as the pieces are getting alternately swapped out.
It's like a relay or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're constantly passing it along, but the chain remains.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, basically the whole article sounds like it's about PKM zeta, but actually it's about how this Kibra molecule turns out to be way, way more important than we thought. Mm-hmm. And Sachter's not done. He's going to keep going until we get our Eternal Sunshine moment, for sure.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of money in it, so can't really fault that passion.
Absolutely. I mean, as much as that movie was a cautionary tale, there's a lot of people who'd be interested.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a therapeutic standpoint, aside from just wanting to forget a girlfriend, if you were doing military service and would really like to forget some things.
Right. Or like Severance, you know, you get to go to your job, forget all about your job when you get out.
I can't wait till that show's a reality. It's got such a hopeful message for the future.
Why wait?
All right. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, we're going to stay in the world of chemistry with James Cordaley. We're going to look at life according to phosphorus. Y'all know about phosphorus?
I mean, I know it's an element.
It is.
I don't know what it has to do with.
That's right. It's a little underrated because the element phosphorus is absolutely essential to life.
Hmm.
as David Vaccari notes, it forms the backbone of DNA and of cellular membranes, and it is the crucial component in the molecular adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, the cell's main form of energy storage. So, big deal, phosphorus.
Yeah, it's another structural thing. That's the theme, is that you need things to hold things up. That's
exactly
important.
Right. It's sort of like the template maker in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the average human contains about 1.5 pounds, or about 650 grams of phosphorus. It's mostly concentrated in our bones, as it is in every other vertebrate, in case you've ever wondered why we use bone meal as a fertilizer and a dietary supplement for livestock. That's some cannibal action happening for sure. But that's because phosphorus is also an essential input for high-yield agriculture. So along with nitrogen and potassium, it's one of the trinity of life-enriching elements that allows the world's farmers to produce the food that feeds over 8 billion of us.
Mm.
And also something like 26 billion chickens, 1.5 billion head of cattle, and 750 million pigs. So agriculture literally mines nutrients from the soil, which means that over time, even the richest soils become depleted. So humans have put all kinds of things as fertilizer to renutrient the soil, including wood ashes, manures, gypsum, fish, horseshoe crabs, and good old standby night soil, which that's an evocative euphemism for human poop.
Yeah, that's just more manure. It's just a different animal.
It is. But, you know, human exceptionalism, we get the poetic term of night soil,
right.
Manure.
Okay.
So we've actually mined islands of bird excrement as a way to keep the crops coming because of how high-yield agriculture requires giant sums. Apparently, and I have not clicked the link, but we have evidently mined battlefields for the bones of dead soldiers.
Oh, that's
You know, we gotta eat. And honestly, the whole phosphorus, the natural cycle of things, that is how it happens. But yeah, we gotta look at scale, right? So today, nitrogen can be synthesized from the air. So it's essentially limitless, at least for right now. Potassium, in the form of salts, we get that from dried up seabeds, and it's quite abundant, expected to last for centuries. But phosphorus is a little bit more limited. Nothing can substitute for it. And as you might expect, we are using it way faster than it is naturally produced. It's a process that takes many millions of years. So with the number of people following meat and dairy-based diets, which consume more phosphorus than plant-based, some have even argued we are approaching peak phosphorus, which sounds a lot like peak oil, but we can live without oil.
Right. So,
phosphorus comes from mined rock. Now, 4 countries control 83% of the world's reserves and 2/3 of current production. Those countries, Morocco, China, the U.S., and South Africa.
Huh.
So Morocco tops the list for reserves because its share includes the resources of Western Sahara. But the U.S.'s major source in Florida is expected to run out in a few decades.
Oh.
But that's not the only problem we're having with phosphorus, y'all. So not only are we using it at a way faster rate than it can be replenished, and it's got way unequal distribution across the world, phosphorus makes everything grow. So when it enters the water through runoff from farm fields or oceans of animal waste created by factory meat production, you get supercharged algae blooms.
Mm.
These algae suck so much oxygen out of the water that nothing else can live in the water, which results in a hypoxic dead zone. When it comes to cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, the end result of one of these blooms can be deadly masses of cytotoxins. So in recent years, these have been threatening drinking water supplies and closing beaches and even fishing industries from the Finger Lakes to the Great Lakes to Florida. But there are arguments that greater efficiencies in phosphorus usage need to become more vital, especially considering that a lot of what's currently applied to farms is just getting washed off or leached off in the rain. So modern day Americans may prefer not to think about the history of using night soil as a manure, but such practices were once as common here as they still are in other parts of the world. For example, good old New York City, home of some of the most productive farmland counties in the U.S. Well, in the second half of the 19th century, they worked on a simple formula. Farmers sent their produce to Manhattan, and Manhattanites sent their feces to the farms.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you could capture the phosphorus runoff a little easier than you could convince people to start maintaining outhouses and shipping their poo. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe one is easier than the other.
It's a good way to frame it, though. Like, if climate change, for climate's sake, hasn't really done it for you, well, the poop-pocalypse might.
Right. It's either poop in a bag and ship it, or eat less meat today.
Oh, I'm pooping in a bag.
Yeah, that's, I think a lot of people would make that choice.
Is it a nice bag?
Is it a nice bag?
Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from jpost.com. It's titled, A Study Reveals Beverages Hydrating Better Than Water.
Is it electrolytes? Is it true? It's what plants crave?
Brondo!
So, while water, both still and sparkling, hydrates the body well, beverages with even a little sugar, fat, or protein can hydrate better and help maintain hydration in the body longer. Professor Ronald Moggin from St. Andrews University explained, "The most important factor in hydration is the amount of liquid consumed at one time. The more liquid consumed at once, the faster it is removed from the stomach and absorbed into the bloodstream. What this means is that consuming large quantities of liquid quickly may not be as effective for hydration as sipping smaller amounts over a longer period." Milk, both skim and whole, is more hydrating than plain water because it contains proteins, lactose, and fats, which slow down stomach emptying and prolong the hydration process. Milk contains key electrolytes like sodium and potassium, which help improve hydration and maintain the body's water balance. The nutritional components in the fluids consumed also matter for hydration. Beverages containing small amounts of sugar, fat, or protein provide better hydration, but beverages containing large amounts of sugar, such as fruit juices and colas, do not hydrate the body better than fluids with lower sugar content. The study pointed out that osmotic processes draw water from the body into the small intestine to dilute the sugars, causing them to spend more time in the stomach and empty more slowly than plain water. This means that while high sugar beverages tend to remain in the stomach longer, they do not provide significant hydration benefits. Furthermore, the research highlighted that beverages like coffee and tea can contribute to hydration. A regular cup of coffee won't dehydrate you, but too much caffeine can cause mild dehydration.
Because it's a diuretic, right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, just wanted to share this one because I thought it was a nice little thing where it can be like, yeah, I'll have the milk, and it is actually hydrating, too.
Right, but not before bed, because yes. Then you're going to have a nightmare.
Exactly. Yeah. Timing my liquid lactose intake very carefully over here. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you convinced me to pick up my water bottle and take a sip right now, so good job.
Yeah. Just doing my part, just like the scientists. Next link.
Next link.
This is super short, but this comes from literally the CIA.gov's website.
Oh, no.
So in the CIA, they have a little story section on their website, and they have a story about the Simple Sabotage Field Manual. This previously classified booklet describes ways to train normal people to be purposefully annoying telephone operators, which isn't a thing anymore, dysfunctional train conductors, or befuddling middle managers. Keep in mind that this is all designed for people who are being occupied. That's kind of the idea here. So OSS Director William Wild Bill Donovan had select parts of the manual declassified and disseminated to citizens of enemy states through pamphlets, targeted radio broadcasts, and in person. While the guidebook does contain ideas for serious hardcore sabotage, a good portion of it near the end was like how to start fires.
Okay.
Yeah. Please don't do that. So
right.
Here's a list of five, they say, particularly timeless tips. So if you work at a hotel, office, or local telephone switchboard, again, not a thing, delay putting calls through, give out wrong numbers, cut people off accidentally, or forget to disconnect them so that the line can't be used again. Movie theater patrons, though, please nobody do this one, but it is pretty funny. Bring a bag of moths to the movie theater with you.
You know, the bag of moths you've got in your house.
Just bring a bag. Gather a bag.
Time to befriend some entomologists.
Yeah, and then for managers and supervisors, I think most of them already do this without realizing. To lower morale and production, think of the worst boss you've had and act like that.
Nice. Yeah. They're like, we don't have to tell you how to do this. You know, yeah. Just think of the guy.
Right. Be pleasant to inefficient workers. Give them undeserved promotions. Discriminate against efficient workers, complain unjustly about their work, and when possible, refer all matters to committees for further study and consideration. For employees, be forgetful, clumsy, work slowly, think of ways to increase the number of movements needed in your job.
Oh, like adding AI as a process in everything you're doing, right? That's right. Cool.
Yeah. For transportation, make train or air travel as inconvenient as possible. One particular effective trick: issue two tickets for the same seat on the train in order to set up a, quote, interesting argument. Wow. That's kind of where the article ends. I went to the field manual, and a good portion of the beginning of the field manual is how to keep people involved in this sabotage when they otherwise wouldn't want to be, right? So remind them of the greater purpose. Like, if your little simple sabotage will get Commissioner X out in Y number of years, right, is kind of the idea. Remind them of that. And don't do anything that's beyond you. So they were like, if you're not a bomb maker, don't build a bomb.
Yeah, right. This is where stay in your lane is very good advice.
Yeah, literally, it's like, just bring matches. It's like, oi, okay, all right. Again, this is for occupied countries.
Right. I mean, it's a question of who's attending the movie screening. If it's just the one chance any of you get to see a movie, maybe moths aren't the right call. But if it's like, oh, yeah, all the soldiers are on leave today watching some patriotic thing,
right,
taking a break from killing you, let's put some moths in their face, you know? That's all right.
Or just go to, what's the cube movie with all the cubes?
Minecraft.
And there's a scene in Minecraft where the kids now are throwing popcorn and it's pretty awful.
It's basically like Rocky Horror Picture Show, but for children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they just ruin the theaters. It's a cool new TikTok trend.
Yeah. I've seen some theaters have like literally a scheduled printout of when each scene is. So they can go in and do crowd control at key minutes of the movie.
Wow. Well, they want to bring people back in the theater. It's going to come at a cost, right?
Right. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include how smell guides our inner world, math's block stacking problem has a preposterous solution, and tomatoes in the Galapagos Islands appear to be evolving in reverse. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.